Welcome into this NCAA tournament edition of the Dayton and Victory podcast here on musketeerreport.com. I am Rick. He is Dan. And for this podcast, we are joined by the legend, Brian Snow. Guys, it was a nice weekend at the Big East tournament. Dan and I both attended. Xavier, of course, beat Marquette 68-65 to pretty much ensure that they were in the tournament, although only barely. We'll get to that in a minute. And then they fell to Creighton 86-78 in a game that, you know, McDermott was McDermott from the get-go and got Creighton out to an early lead, and X just couldn't make enough shots to get back into it. They cut it down to a five-point game after being down by 19 in the second half, so no lack of fighting the team this weekend, but just didn't quite have enough to beat Creighton at Madison Square, which, you know, not a lot of teams did until Providence in the finals. So, guys, first of all, Dan, we'll start with you. Overall impressions from the weekend of the way Xavier played and your takeaways with what they showed in Madison Square.
Well, I want to start by talking about the Creighton game a little bit, because we had some technical difficulties with the post game pod. So we had done some analysis and unfortunately it got eaten by the internet. But the key moment in this game came right before the under eight TV timeout in the first half. Creighton had started out real hot from the field. Xavier was really struggling to deal with them. Oddly, in half court situations, it wasn't Creighton getting out and running and hitting threes like they're prone to do. But X got the lead down to 24-20. Samaje was starting to get to the basket. Justin had hit a big three. And then in the space of about a minute, you had Justin Martin and Jalen Reynolds both picking up their second foul, having to go to the bench for the remainder of the first half. And Creighton just sort of poured it on from there. The lead went from 4-15 over the course of about 6 minutes. Matt Stainbrook knocked down a three to close it to 12, which was surprising.
Money. Straight.
And then in the second half, you know, I think what happened was that that X just got tired. They put their head down a little bit. They couldn't get the game under into single digits at the beginning of the second half. Put their head down a little bit. They just got torn apart for about 2 minutes, where Creighton had three straight baskets on easy pick and rolls. McDermott gets loose for a three, and it was 19 points. And at that point, you know, the Muskies could have just packed it in and headed back to Cincinnati, but they really did a nice job. I thought they showed a lot of fight. They took advantage of Creighton kind of losing the plot a little bit. Not a team that's really built to sit on a big lead like that, because they don't really like to have long possessions. So X was able to cut it down to 5 or 6 points toward the end of the game. But the foul trouble, the fact that Matt Stainbrook really wasn't able to be effective on back-to-back nights, he only played 9 minutes against Creighton. You know, the Muskies just really, it wasn't that they played that poorly against Creighton. That was just, it was just a game where if Creighton was going to get off from the 3-point line, which they did for the first 30 minutes of the game, it was just going to be extraordinarily difficult for Xavier to hang. But they, as you said, they showed a lot of fight in the second half. They didn't just let the game get away from them. And they were in there, you know, it was a long shot, but they were in there with a chance with about 2 or 3 minutes left. And that's really all you could ask for, given the hole that they were in at the beginning of the second half.
Yeah, Dan, the key stretch you mentioned where Creighton got about 3 or 4 easy baskets on pick and roll situations, what you saw was Xavier tried to do things differently in this game. They were switching everything. They were mixing and matching almost kind of depending on the personnel. And Jalen Reynolds was in there, and I don't think he quite got exactly what they were doing. Everyone else was doing it one way, and he was doing it the way they usually do it, and that led to a post guy being wide open. And that's the problem with – that's Jalen's growth right now, and that's part of the problem having a freshman on that stage. So, I mean, it is what it is. I mean, you know, Jalen wasn't trying to make mistakes. Samaje wasn't trying to – it's just – it's not something they had a lot of time to practice, but with the way Creighton was shooting – it was the only way they could defend that situation, because you're not leaving Rogge on the pick and roll. Not happening. And then if you have a dive guy, it would have been all screwed up. So they tried to switch it. Jalen didn't quite grasp how they wanted to do it, and easy buckets happened. That said, they played hard. And honestly, I thought they played pretty well. Just, you know, they were switching baskets with Creighton. It was just Creighton's were worth 3 and Xavier's were worth 2. And even though my Ohio State degree isn't worth much, it tells me three is worth more than two. And that's how Creighton was able to extend their lead. So, but overall, I thought Xavier played pretty well in the game. It was just Creighton's a better team, and I don't think anyone's really going to argue with that.
Yeah, I completely agree. The biggest thing about what I saw out of Xavier is, you know, Matt Stainbrook on the second night just wasn't even close to being effective. I mean, he couldn't move at all. And obviously Creighton is a bad matchup for him. So you look at NC State, they always have a typical post player at the five. So that will help him, that he can stay around the basket, won't have to chase jump shooters around the perimeter. But I mean, it's just going to be interesting to see how quickly that he can recover. And then obviously the big question after that is, will he be worth anything on Thursday night if they do advance? But you got to win the first one first. And I will say, against Marquette, I thought he did provide them with what they needed, which, I mean, as soon as he came into the game, he got an assist to D. Davis for a three, and he did make a difference when he was in there, even though he wasn't quite 100%.
Yeah, he did honestly, enough. Oh, go ahead. Go ahead, Brian. Sorry.
Honestly, even if he was 100%, I'm not sure he would have played much more against Creighton than he did.
Yeah, I agree.
The coaching staff in the first, or the, not the first Creighton game, the second Creighton game, they thought they were better with Jalen on the floor as opposed to Matt. And I just think it was going to be a game where Matt wasn't going to play very much.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. But the 9 minutes that he was on the court, he could not move at all. I mean, he looked horrible.
I don't know if you guys could see it there. I want to say a couple minutes in the first half, he seemed to retweak his knee or something.
I thought the same thing.
And he wasn't quite the same after that. That said, you know, I don't think it was in their plans to play Matt much more than 10, 12 minutes as it was. So
no, I agree with you there, but I just think, you know, he's obviously a big part of what this team does and what makes this team go on the offensive end. And you know, the nice thing is, I think NC State is going to be a great matchup for Jalen Reynolds, so we can get in more into that. But first, I want to talk about the Big East tournament as a whole. Dan, the atmosphere there over those couple of days was incredible. The renovations to Madison Square Garden, the place is perfect. It's everything you want it to be when you walk in, from when you're up on top of the bridge at the very top of the stadium to when we were sitting courtside for the first couple nights. I mean, it was perfect. And the atmosphere from the fans was much better than what everyone expected it to be going in, I think.
Yeah, I think that there was a little bit of trepidation from some people about, you know, how's this going to come off? Because, you know, this tournament had such a legendary atmosphere in previous years, helped along by schools like Syracuse and UConn that are close by, that have big fan bases. But I'll tell you what, start that quarterfinal day, four games, three of them phenomenal basketball games, the third one being McDermott at scoring 27 in the first half and putting on an absolute show against DePaul, was as good an atmosphere as I've been around in basketball. And you talk about the arena itself. I mean, after X went out in the semifinal, during the final, you know, you and I took the opportunity to walk around. We sat in a couple different places over the last two nights during the non-Xavier games just to check it out. And it's just that it's just such a completely first-class venue in every regard. I mean, from the courtside seating where we were for the play-in games on the first day, as you said, all the way up to that Chase Bridge, which basically is you hanging out right over the court from the third level, which was actually where Byron and Joe were calling the game from for the radio broadcast. And we sat up there for the final and it was perfect.
Yeah. I mean, it was the best view you could ever have if you want to see what's actually going on. From an X's and O perspective, it was awesome.
There's a reason coaches keep their cameras up there for games.
Yeah.
And so and what you said about the fans, I mean, obviously I don't think we realized how well Creighton was going to travel.
They were everywhere in the city.
It was pretty stunning. I mean, I would say that they had by far the most fans in the building. Maybe during the St. John's Providence game, they were outnumbered a little bit, but they were fantastic too. I mean, a gracious group of fans. They, you know, there were no incidents that I witnessed. I mean, it was a good atmosphere, and it didn't seem like a hostile atmosphere. It seemed
no, the bars were actually
pretty
good
natured. So I thought it was great. I thought it was really a celebration of this league. I thought it came off as well as anybody could have expected. The fact that there were so many great competitive games from Butler and Seton Hall on the first night, Georgetown and DePaul the way through to the final, which was fantastic.
Well, and let's be honest, it was huge for this conference to have Doug McDermott doing what he was doing and being a National Player of the Year. Having him doing what he did in Madison Square Garden was huge for this conference tournament.
Oh, absolutely. And while it probably would have been maybe a better spectacle in terms of having a competitive game, in terms of having like a super competitive national profile game, had Villanova made the final and played Creighton again, that Providence-Creighton matchup was really interesting. And Providence really playing for their NCAA tournament lives produced one of the more gutty performances I've seen all year. So I really enjoyed it. I had a blast. I'm fully intend to go back next year. And yeah, it was just a great 4 days in New York City.
Snow, what'd you think about it? Watching it from afar in Indianapolis or whatever you were doing.
I was in Houston, and by the way, Houston sucks. just see, I love Dallas. I love Austin. Houston is terrible. What the hell happened? I don't get it, but I diverge. On TV, it played well. You know, I didn't get to see every game. I did get to see Bo Xavier games just because of the timing. But, TV, it played very well. It seemed like the atmosphere was good. It looked packed. I don't know how packed it was. And in MSG, it's tough to tell. But it looked like there was a lot of people there. So it certainly played well. My question to you guys is, next year when Creighton comes back down to earth and they bring half as many people, do you think that's going to have a major impact on things?
It's gonna be interesting to see which teams are much better. I mean, you know, I think you've already seen it a little bit on our board. I mean, that doesn't represent the whole fan base, but I think Xavier will travel much better next year because I think fan expectations will be higher and they'll think they have a chance for a long stay. I think, you know, if Marquette's better, they're a fan base that would travel pretty well.
Yeah.
I think it depends. If St. John's, they should be one of the top half teams, so they'll represent well again with having their fan base in the city already. So it'll be interesting to see. I think I likened it to, it wasn't quite, I was in, you know, Atlanta for the Xavier Baylor game, Sweet 16 game a couple years ago, and UK was there at the same time. So it wasn't quite like Atlanta, but Creighton fans looked a little bit like UK fans with the way they were piling up in every single bar you went to and all over the street in the entire city. They came strong.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I think Snow makes a good point. Next year, you know, Creighton probably profiling as a team that might be playing in that first A. But I do think, Rick, what you said, Marquette and Georgetown, two pretty big fan bases that really probably came into this tournament thinking they had no chance to do much. So it'll be interesting to see if next year, if those two programs rebound a little bit, if they travel a little bit better. Snow, in terms of how packed it was, I mean, the first night the attendance wasn't great, but quarterfinal day, it felt like 80-85% full for the whole day. And then for the final, there were empty seats, but they were all way up top. I don't know what the official attendance was, but if MSG sits 20, I'm going to guess 17 or 18 for the final, probably about the same for the semi. So there were good crowds. I wouldn't say the place was packed to the rafters, but talking about 12 pretty small schools at the end of the day. And the Creighton fans really stole the show in terms of the way that they packed the place and the number.
Dan, I'm not sure if you're aware, but in the Big East, there's 10 schools, not 12.
Did I say 12?
Yeah, you did.
Oh, okay. Well,
all right. It was a long weekend, Snow. Shut up. all right. So obviously, Selection Sunday, we said Xavier was in. They got in. I didn't think they would be in the play-in game. I still think they got screwed a little bit. As it is, they're playing North Carolina State tomorrow night. We're recording this Monday night at 11:30. So they'll be tipping off Tuesday, 9:10 in Dayton. Initial thoughts on where Xavier got seated and general thoughts overall in the brackets, fellas.
I'll start. I thought Xavier was a touch low. I didn't bracketology it out. I just went over the last 10 teams, and I thought Xavier had the 64th best resume, which would have put them, the last team in, probably playing Ohio State if you really broke it down. So that's what I thought they would be. It turns out, I guess they were 67. So the committee had them a few spots lower, but I mean, if you're quibbling on that, you know, quite honestly, you know, deal with it. So they were a touch low, but I don't think it was terrible. Now they were, you know, having BYU ahead of them is completely and totally inexcusable. Tennessee, inexcusable, but you know, you could argue with Dayton, you could argue with Nebraska. I personally thought Nebraska had a slightly better resume than Xavier. I thought Xavier had a slightly better resume than Dayton. But it just, you know, it is what it is. There were the fact that St. Louis is a six or five or what five. There are five, which is just an abomination. And then that's only topped by UMass's six seed, which is a complete joke. I think you will see the betting favorite against each of those teams from the play-in game be the favorite. I think either Xavier or NC State and Iowa or Tennessee will be the favorite over those two teams that are just grossly, grossly overseeded.
I guess I didn't really have a problem with the teams that got in. I think NC State, you know, their resume might have been a bit questionable, but when you're talking about the last at large team, you know, whether it's them, whether it's Wisconsin, Green Bay, whoever you would have picked is going to have some holes and some issues. The problem I have is that the seeding just seems to be completely off the wall. It feels like the first couple seed lines are okay and defensible, but once they got to Louisville, it just feels like they were throwing darts at a board to pick some of these seeds.
Dan, let me cut you off for a second with Louisville's resume. First of all, everyone's talking about, oh, they passed the look test. They beat Rutgers by 60. Who gives a crap? And then they beat Houston or whatever by 30. But this is what happens in football. We overrate the heck out of Baylor and Oregon because they beat Little Sisters of the Poor by 80, while Alabama and Ohio State and LSU will do it by 20. We're like, oh my God, they won by – who cares? You blew them out. So Louisville blew out bad teams. I've seen Louisville up close in person twice. Everyone's talking about, oh my God, the look test. They're not that good. If they pass the look test at such an elite level, so does Cincinnati. So I don't really quite get this Louisville thing, not to mention all of their wins are against – well, they lost twice to Memphis, so they couldn't even get that. They got UC by 1 point in a creatively officiated game at the end. They got SMU, who's not that good, who had all of four top 100 wins, once again all against the AAC teams. And then UConn they got – on the third day and 3 days in a row after UConn had just played Cincinnati and Memphis.
Memphis, yeah.
Let's stop with this eye test on Louisville. Their resume is not very good. Honestly, their resume is a 7-8 seat resume. They were given the benefit of the doubt.
The issue that I have with this is that there's a couple issues I have with it. First of all, I don't care what system the selection committee uses to pick and select the teams, as long as they're consistent in the way that it's applied. So if you're going to use the RPI, that's fine. But make it clear that you're going to use the RPI and don't deviate from using the RPI to help out certain teams. If your position is that a team's out-of-conference scheduling is the most paramount thing, and it doesn't really matter how many of those games you win as long as you play them, i.e. why BYU's in the field, i.e. why UMass is seated where they are, then why is Kentucky an 8 seed? Because you look at their resume and they played an extraordinarily difficult non-conference schedule. They had a lot of close losses to the teams that they played. But I mean, that's the issue that I have with it, it's inconsistent in the way that it was applied to certain teams. And, you know, at the end of the day, I don't think that you can make too many arguments about where Xavier specifically was seated. I think probably Snow Xavier was going to have a bye into the real first round until Providence won the Big East tournament and they couldn't be in the playoff game, in the play-in game. I bet Providence might have gotten that play-in game spot had they not won the Big East tournament. But you know, some of these other decisions you mentioned UMass, it seems like every single one of the A-10 teams are a significant overseed, maybe with the exception of VCU. And I'm not sure what message we're supposed to take from that, because I watched a little bit of A-10 basketball, not as much as maybe as I have in previous years, obviously, but I don't see how you can make a legitimate argument that the quality of play in the Atlantic 10 is anywhere close to the quality of play in the Big East. So I'm not saying that there were six teams in the Big East that deserved to get in, but you're going to tell me that Xavier's five seed lines below UMass? You're going to tell me that Providence is, you know, five seed lines behind UMass? That seems crazy to me. So I think that there are things you can definitely quibble with. We can talk about the computer. I know you don't really want to talk about the computer rankings. I would recommend that people take a look at Nate Silver's article on 538, where he talks about some of the issues he had with the seeding process. And I think the most interesting thing, Snow, you name check this, is going to be to see how some of these lines look that Vegas sets on these games, because I think there's going to be some surprises for people about how little certain teams are favored by. Especially maybe some of these Atlantic 10 teams. I mean, you said St. Louis and UMass could be underdogs to the teams that come out of the playing games. I mean, that neither of those would surprise me in the slightest bit.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I do want to say, though, I think 2 weeks ago, I saw UMass play at Dayton live in person in color. And then I saw Creighton play at Xavier. So in one day, I saw a 3 seed, a 6 seed, an 11 and a 12. There's not very much difference between those four teams. There's just not. And I think that's the nature of college basketball this year. You know, I saw Louisville and Cincinnati three or four days before that. You know, like, not a big difference. I mean, any team out, you know, really can beat any team. I mean, you got Kentucky really should have won against Florida. They had Florida on the ropes yesterday. I think this year there's just going to be a lot of quote unquote seed upsets that aren't really like upsets if you've really watched the teams play and know what they're made of.
Well, the bizarre thing about it is that a lot of teams, if the committee wants to throw out your conference results effectively and focus on your non-conference RPI and strength of schedule, and then just sort of look at the total, then it totally is advantageous to teams to play in conferences where there is a huge line between the good teams and the bad teams, like in the AAC this year, although obviously SMU took maybe the bad beat on Selection Sunday. But as we talked in the AAC, most of those teams started with 10 conference wins, and then they just beat up on each other at the top of the league, and they all end up with really gaudy RPIs. I mean, does that really tell you that those teams are intrinsically better than the middle class of the Big East that just beat each other senseless for 3 months? I don't know.
Which is the hole. That hole in the system has always been there.
Oh, no doubt.
I go back probably 5-6 years ago. Dayton, Chris Wright, he ended up hurting his foot, but they got off to that unbelievable start. They beat Pittsburgh. They beat someone else. They won in Hawaii or whatever the heck it was. Then Chris Wright gets hurt. Brian Roberts is sick. They come to the Cintas Center and get beat by 130. And I don't even think it was that close. And that year, like, all of a sudden the A-10, its middle class just beat the bejesus out of each other. And I think the league only got like 2 or 3 bids, where at the end of non-conference, it looked like it was going to get 6 just because there was a strong – if you have a strong middle class, it honestly hurts your bids, and it has always been that way.
All right. Well, we are dragging on a little long here, so let's get into this North Carolina State preview and talk a little bit about the matchup. Obviously, the first thing when you think of North Carolina State is TJ Warren, averaging just under 25 points a game, but over the last 5 or 6 games, he's just been incredible. I mean, he scored 36 against North Carolina, 41 and 42 in back-to-back games against Pitt and Boston College, and he hasn't scored less than 20 in like 3 months. So, Snow, we've both seen a ton of him in the AAU circuit, then playing at Brewster, and now at North Carolina State. To an extent, this is just a guy that's going to get his, and it's more about stopping the rest of the team, is it not?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a Creighton situation. Not quite as obvious, but it's a Creighton situation where, you know, Justin Martin's going to get fried by TJ Warren. just going to happen, even if he plays the game of his life defensively. TJ is going to get his buckets. But you can't let Jordan Vandenberg somehow get 10 or Leonard Freeman get 4 offensive rebounds for 8 points or let Cat Barber score or have Desmond Lee hit 4 threes. If you can control the rest of the team, you're going to be fine because they don't guard anybody. So it comes down to TJ is going to get his, you're going to get yours. Can you control their other pieces? And that's what Xavier has to do.
Yeah, I talked earlier today to James Henderson from our North Carolina State scout site, and he basically told me that the most important thing for this team and them winning is finding that secondary scorer to T.J. Warren.
Their main other scoring option has been Roston Turner. He's a transfer from LSU, a two-guard who's really kind of been pretty much essentially their lone perimeter option. I mean, he's a guy who shoots 37-38% from three, and you know, when he's hitting, he's a lot like D. Davis. I mean, when he's hitting, they're tough to beat, because when you have a guy who's consistently giving you 20 to 30, 35 points a night, you know, if you can get one other player step up and give you 15 to 20, you're going to be tough to beat. And, you know, that's been the case with them. I mean, TJ, I think he's on a streak where he scored over 20 and 20-plus games or something crazy like that. So he's, you know, right, what you're getting from him. And it's just on the nights where, you know, Luke Turner can give you three, four, five threes. I mean, that's kind of been their option. And then the other guys just kind of sprinkle in, a lot like Xavier. You know, it may be Leonard Freeman one night. It may be Kyle Washington one night. You know, Vandenberg, I mean, it's the same approach you mentioned, you know, where it's offensive rebounding, some putbacks. They really don't run a lot of stuff for any other guys, to be honest with you, to try and get them touches. It's consistently trying to get Warren or Turner touches within the half-court offense and then maybe get you some offensive putbacks or, you know, some transition buckets from Barber and Lewis and those guys.
So there you go. It's like a Creighton situation mixed with a St. John situation because they really don't run anything.
Yeah, what'll be interesting is what every team in the ACC has started to do and been very effective with, ironically, with the exception of Syracuse, is zoning North Carolina State. But they also match up really well with Xavier in a man-to-man, or Xavier matches up with them really well man-to-man. So I think Xavier will start out man-to-man. But if for some reason NC State decides to go with TJ Warren at the four, what I think you will do, instead of seeing Xavier match that and go small because Miles Davis can't throw it in the ocean right now, is Xavier will go zone and stay big and really try to punish NC State on the glass on the offensive end with Fillmore, Reynolds, and Stainbrook. So I think that will be interesting to see how exactly Xavier approaches it and then how NC State approaches it, because NC State as a team only shoots 30% from three. So everybody is zoning them.
Yeah, and NC State, you mentioned abusing them on the offensive glass. They're a team that on the defensive end ranks 338th in giving up offensive rebounds. So in the country, that is. So they, and what he mentioned is that, you know, those big guys, they go after so many block shots. They're young and, you know, they have the length. They do block some shots, but they, you know, at the same time, what that leaves them in position to do is give up a ton of offensive rebounds and easy putbacks. So I think you're exactly right, Brian, that Xavier will definitely try to exploit that in this matchup. You know,
it's interesting. NC State, they're a little bit like Xavier. They don't really score many points at all from behind the 3-point arc. I mean, they're actually one of the few teams in D1 that scores less of their points on threes than the Muskies do. I mean, X at least shoots a pretty respectable percentage. NC State's 30.3% this year, which is over 300th in Division I, and they only get 18% of their points from the 3-point arc, which is almost dead last in Division I. So sort of a similar situation with the Muskies in that they don't take a lot of threes and they don't hit a lot of threes. So maybe that'll help out X a little bit, because obviously perimeter defense has been something that's popped up and bitten them quite a few times this year.
Well, and I think we also saw in that Marquette game, Xavier played their best zone of the year, in my opinion, when they went zone in that game. I thought that was the best they have looked and the most solid they have done job they have done without giving up easy buckets and having major breakdowns in the zone. So that is something that I could see happening as the game wears on. You know, James and I also talked about what happens to this North Carolina State team when they lose. And here's what he had to say about that.
I mean, it's generally, you know, it's either you don't find another scoring option to complement Warren. Really, a lot of times when they have issues, it's playing teams that hit three-point shots. You know, they're big, because they're so focused on trying to prevent you from that, they're scheme-wise, that if you do hit those, they're really in trouble. You know, Duke's really hurt them from there both times they faced Duke. I'm trying to think of teams that didn't play them. I'm trying to think of teams that really kind of exploited them. Like teams that don't hit threes, they tend to play very well against. Like, for instance, you know, when I look at the game plans going in, North Carolina doesn't shoot threes well. They played Carolina tough at home. Syracuse doesn't shoot threes well. They played them tough. You know, teams like that, they tend to play fairly well against. And then it's just consistently finding that other guy to step up and take shots. You know, I mentioned Turner. The problem with him is when he's not hitting, he's still going to shoot. But, you know, they're fine with it because they need him to take those shots, if that makes sense.
Right.
You know, I mean, he may give you a 2-for-10 night from three, but they need him to take that because they may in that game only shoot 13 threes, you know, because they don't have really anybody else. You know, Warren will shoot you 1 to 2, maybe 3 a game. But outside of that, you know, their point guards don't want to shoot threes. Their other reserve wing, he's not a 3-point shooter, so they really look to Turner for any 3-point production. So they kind of give him a little bit of the green light. And when he's not on, you know, it's kind of tough when you're not getting that outside production because they don't really run stuff, you know, for anybody else but him and Warren half court wise.
And then he also mentioned that on the defensive end, they're gonna play mostly, or at least they want to play mostly man to man, but they do adjust sometimes based on the matchups.
They're gonna pressure the ball. Now again, a lot of it might be scout based. You know, they'll look at scout and see, you know, this guy's like, for instance, what I can guarantee you with Xavier, they'll go under ball screens on Samaj Christian and make him take that jump shot. You know, I mean, that's kind of been their MO. They play the percentages defensively where, you know, if you're not a guy who shows you can hit a 3-point shot, you know, we're going to go under ball screens all game and make you hit them. They kind of adjust their personnel and their scheme based on who they're facing. You know, they'll probably hedge more ball screens with Christian to take away the drive. I mean, they'll mix it up and change it up, but they're going to apply ball pressure. They want to try and make you, you know, not as comfortable out on the perimeter. And again, it's because they feel like they have shot blockers in the paint. So what they like to do is they like to pressure the ball out front, force you to the three, you know, force you to the rim where they feel like they can contest shots. It's probably one of the reasons why, you know, statistically, I think they're in the top 40 maybe nationally in defending the three-point shot, because they just really like to run teams off the three-point line and send them into the paint. And again, that's kind of an issue where, you know, you've got to be able to block those shots or be smart in the ones you do contest. And that's kind of the thing they battled this year, is on games where they're smart there. They're really tough to handle because, you know, they're gonna be there to contest shots but also rebound. But then when they get out of control, you know, they leave a lot of chances for offensive putbacks. But they're gonna be a ball pressure team out on the perimeter for sure.
You know, obviously I think they'll probably play off Samaje like most teams have done against him, but I think that's gonna be interesting to see. He's gonna get his chances to attack the rim in one-on-one situations. It's gonna be interesting to see him going at those young shot blockers and whether he takes it at them, tries to get them in foul trouble, or whether he's dumping off to Jalen. This could be a big night for Jalen, having weak side rebounds, which he does very well, and putbacks, and also dump offs or lobs from Samaje or D driving into the paint.
The other guy who's really, really good at that is Justin Martin. He's an excellent offensive rebounder.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think he's one, and TJ Warren doesn't show much of an interest in blocking out. That's not really his role. So I think that'll be something to watch.
All right, guys. So should we weigh in on predictions here? I see that Vegas makes X a 2.5-point favorite tomorrow night. I guess from my perspective, this is a game that Xavier ought to win, but I can't say I have a huge amount of confidence that they'll be able to pull it out. I think there's a lot of uncertainty still about Stainbrook. Obviously, one of the things you would have preferred would be for X to get into the tournament proper, so you'd have a couple extra days for him to rest. So it'll be interesting to see how much he can play and how effective he can be, because of course when he doesn't play, Xavier's offense loses a key component, even if it's not him that's actually making the shots. So I would say that I would tentatively pick Xavier in this game, but I would say it would not surprise me if the Muskies went out.
I obviously we've already broken down the reasons, what Xavier would have to do to win, what North Carolina State needs to get out of, a guy like Ralston Turner. I think the big thing here is Xavier offensive rebounds. I think that's something they do very well. That's something North Carolina State gives up, and that's not a huge variable. You don't, we've seen it before, but you don't typically miss a lot of point blank putbacks. If they're relying on a guy to make threes in a weird environment at Dayton, I mean, UD Arena is a pretty unique environment, in my opinion, to play at. So I wouldn't rely on shooting very well, and I wouldn't put my money on that. So I like Xavier's chances because of where they might be able to exploit North Carolina State, and I think it's going to be a high scoring game. I'm going Xavier 78, North Carolina State 75.
I'll take the under on that, but I do think, if I had to guess, I think this is a good styles make fights, and I think this is a pretty good personnel matchup for Xavier for a few reasons. One, NC State's young point guards don't really like ball pressure, and D. Davis is probably the best on ball defender in the Big East. Tyler Lewis, when he's in, he wants nothing to do with that. And then Cat Barber can get a little wild as well. So I don't know that NC State's going to be able to get the ball to the places they want to get it to on time, on target. Also, the rebounding, like we've mentioned. And then most importantly, the thing that's hurt Xavier this year is mobile bigs who can shoot. NC State does not have those. So to me, the ways you beat Xavier are mobile bigs who can shoot, and then bigger physical guards who really attack the rim. And those two things do not exist on NC State's roster. So I would guess Xavier by 3 or 4 or 5. But if NC State wins, I'm not going to be shocked.
And then I think that in my view, I mean, the St. Louis matchup is almost more favorable for Xavier than this NC State matchup. I mean, I think, especially with as badly as they've played over the last 2 or 3 weeks.
St. Louis is not a very good basketball team.
No, and they're playing terrible right now. And then again, the biggest thing, the problem that with the play-in game creates is you got that short turnaround on the scout. I mean, obviously they're already scouting that next team in case, but with St. Louis, they know what they have to do. They're familiar with all the actions. I mean, this is going to be a very easy scout and something that the players can pick up on pretty quickly. They've seen this stuff before. They've worked on it before.
The other variable there is that, of course, you've got, this game tomorrow night. I've been to the first four before. Although it is at UD Arena and it is on, some TV channel that like 55 people get, they still have the full CBS TV timeouts, and the games are about 3.5 hours long. So they may not. So even if they win, they may not get out of Dayton until 2 or 3 in the morning. And then the game in Orlando, I think, would be at Thursday at 7:00 p.m. or something like that. So it'd be a pretty quick travel. Obviously, the Muskies would love to do it, but it does give you, concerns again when you're talking about a critical player who's got a knee injury that. You don't know what his availability is going to be on that short turnaround.
Here's the other thing about that, though. Xavier is able to charter. If they were not in the play-in game, they would not be able to charter. The travel situation might be a little bit better than it would be otherwise.
That's a good point. I didn't think about that.
Yeah, that's very nice.
Last thing I wanted to ask you guys is how you see the outlook for the other Big East teams in the NCAA tournament.
I like Providence over Carolina, and then I like them losing. I see Villanova getting to about the Elite Eight and Creighton to the Elite Eight, because I think Creighton has a favorable matchup against Wisconsin because they'll hit more threes than Wisconsin will, though we might set a record for most white guys minutes played in that game if it does happen.
I'll say this. I felt a lot better about Creighton's chances before I saw how bad Ethan Rogge was moving in the interview room after the semifinal. You remember that, Rick?
Yeah.
He was wearing about an 80-pound brace on his knee, and he looked terrible. So he played, did not play well at all in the Providence game.
And his legs just looked completely dead, which was no shock. I mean, we talked about that probably three or four different times that night after that game. It's like, man, he is not going to be okay tomorrow with the way he was limping out of there. And sure enough, I mean, he just had nothing when he went to shoot the ball that night.
But, you know, he obviously doesn't rely on his mobility a great deal. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see some of these teams. I guess, you know, one of the cool things about the NCAA tournament always is that, you know, Creighton's now played like 21 straight games against the same nine teams, not 11, Snow, nine, same nine teams. And Xavier, you know, their last 20 games have been in Big East play, Providence 21, whatever else. So it'll be interesting to see how they match up with some of those other teams. Bryce Cotton against the North Carolina Guards, that'll be pretty cool to watch.
Yeah. Quickly, other local teams, Cincinnati going against Harvard, UK going against Kansas State, and Dayton, Ohio State. What do you guys think about those matchups?
Ohio State, I think Dayton matches up terribly with Ohio State. Ohio State's guards will give Dayton just fits. I just think I'm not real high on Ohio State.
They really need Seibert and Samford to just hit some shots or something, or they're going to be in big trouble.
The problem is, like, those guys, like, Samford can dribble. I love Jordan Seibert. That's my little brother, but he doesn't dribble it very well.
Right.
And yep. Shannon Scott's going to be in them. Sam Thompson's going to be in those guys. I just think personnel wise, Dayton doesn't have what you need to beat Ohio State. And then let's not even talk about Aaron Kraft guarding Kyrie Price. That's a terrible
unfair
matchup
that's
for Dayton.
Unfair.
So I don't think Ohio State's a very good team, but I think that's just a dream matchup for them. Then I see Ohio State getting trounced in the next round. UK, I think they get by Kansas State because Kansas State isn't good away from home. And then they have everything that Wichita State doesn't want to see. Loads of big guys and big physical guards. I think they beat Wichita State, and then they get beat by Louisville, who I think will beat Xavier. And then Cincinnati. Everyone's trying to pick, like, Harvard as this trendy upset. Harvard will be lucky to get to 50.
Yeah.
Now, granted, UC might be as well, but Harvard ain't scoring on UC.
Right. That's the thing that cracks me up. It's like, this is going to be a complete rock fight, and people keep talking about how that's the trendy upset pick. I'm like, that's actually like a dream matchup for UC. It's a team that wants to get down and defend with them and play in a rock fight.
Yeah, Harvard's not scoring. UC's winning that game. And then UC has the grave misfortune of facing a focused and actually giving a crap Michigan State team. Gary Harris will match up with Sean Kilpatrick quite nicely. And then there's the other issue of Keith Appling, Adrian Payne, and Brandon Dawson. So
yeah, that's that Michigan State team has the bigs to really exploit some of the stiffs that UC runs out. I agree with you, Snow. I think that's a nightmare matchup. It is interesting that Vegas only has UC as a 3-point favorite against Harvard. That seems a bit low
to
me.
Take UC.
I do think
the points.
Ohio State getting six against Dayton is interest or giving six.
Lay the points. It's bad personnel matchups.
I think it's a bad personnel matchup, but I kind of agree. But I'll tell you what, I have decided this year, I've seen enough, I've heard enough, that I'm following the Brian Snow method henceforth. When I look at these tournament matchups, I'm looking for pros and I'm looking for teams that can score. And you talked about Jordan Seibert. If he goes crazy from three, you know, Dayton's a pretty good offensive team and Ohio State is not. So maybe there is a chance for them to hang with him if they can just hit a lot of outside shots. But I agree with you. I think Ohio State wins that game.
All right. Well, I guess this does it for the tournament edition of the Dana Victory Podcast, only available on MusketeerReport.com. For Dan and the legend Brian Snow, I am Rick. Thanks for listening, everyone.